Welcome to Rescue Junkies, episode number 3 with Chris Enright, Rowan McClune, and joining us today, special guest who's shaking his head, not wanting to even be recorded, but we're sure he's going to contribute at some point, Taylor Gray. Taylor does wildland shit, medical shit, and makes maps and things like that, and is actually pretty decent at all of that. How long have you been with doing EMS-related stuff, Taylor? Just not even going to answer? We'll see about that. Anyway, so let's start with current events for today. Really, for the past week, one of the more major current events was a line-of-duty death with the FDNY. Firefighter William N. Tolley, of one of the truck companies out there, fell while he was climbing, like, right at the bucket of one of the ladder trucks on a structure fire, like, 3 alarm, I think. Fell about 5 stories down to the ground. Was transported, but ended up succumbing to his injuries as a result of that injury. Pretty tragic, pretty unfortunate circumstances associated with that. But, you know, we can definitely learn a little bit and improve our own practice just based on kind of knowing what happens in other entities.
Now, I'm not certain, but when you climb up to the bucket of a ladder like that, don't you have some sort of heart or like a clip-in that you wear?
It depends based on kind of department policies. A lot of departments don't actually. Your ladder belt is really there for once you get to the top and you clip in when you're in the bucket, but climbing the ladder, a lot of the time you're not tied in or anything like that. It's not like like climbing a tower for rescue work or, you know, doing rope work or anything like
that.
You need to be tied off. For climbing up an aerial ladder, it's often just not a thing. And you look at kind of the old pictures of guys just right up at the tip of a ladder, just hanging on, just kind of like, yeah, I'm just here, hanging on to the top of a ladder that's shooting water out at 600 gallons per minute or something crazy. I'm not like that. Pretty unfortunate, but a good safety note for all of us to think about the next time you're doing anything at heights. Make sure that you're squared away and you're watching out. Pretty tragic news, but something to think about, something to be considering. All right, let's move on. Gear review.
Yeah.
So, today, knives.
Yeah, we're going to talk some knives today.
Knives, and more knives. So,
why don't you start with yours?
Yeah, so kind of my everyday carry kind of go-to knife is the Benchmade Adamas. I went with the folding version. I also have a fixed blade version. I carry the fixed blade in one of my packs and just kind of leave it in there. It's a pretty bomber survival knife. And I carry the kind of the folding one on a day-to-day basis. It's an awesome knife. I love it. One of the reviews I saw, like, that sold me on buying it was, quote, "I ordered a knife, but a tank showed up in the mail." Like, all right, cool. I like that. And so I ended up buying the knife. Sure enough, the thing is just bomber. Heavy-grade construction, good thick blade that's still pretty sharp and maintains an edge for a while. I've liked it. It's been a great knife. Just a little under 4 inches blade length.
Is there any is there any reason that you'd carry, like, in a non-survival pack kind of thing, a fixed blade over a folding knife?
Where, in a pack, carry a fixed
In a, you know, in your survival pack, you can throw in a fixed blade. But
yeah.
Is there any reason to carry a fixed blade knife, in your opinion?
On a day-to-day basis?
Yeah.
Probably not.
I mean, there
are kind of the mountain men, you know, woodsman types who are, like, doing stuff.
Yeah, outside of people who are, like, lumberjacks and
people
who use tools like that. I mean, people who are just kind of day-to-day folks who like to carry a knife.
There are a lot of people who, you know, live out in the country, etc., who are doing a lot of work on a day-to-day basis where a sharp fixed blade knife is an everyday necessity.
Yeah.
If you're at the point where your knife is out a lot of the time and you're getting annoyed with the time that you spend unfolding it and taking it out of your pocket, then maybe it's time to consider a fixed blade knife.
Yeah, that's a fair estimate.
Also, if you're doing wood carving or something like that,
you probably want
a nice little fixed knife that you hang out on your belt, and a nice little leather holster and all that. It's something to consider, but it's a little goofy for everyday use. I know the guys who, you know, I've seen a couple people just in everyday life who carry a fixed blade knife on their belt. It's like, they also wear cowboy hats in weird places that are inappropriate for it, and wear like wear gear, but hey, like
a cowboy hat and boots is appropriate in church where I come from.
It's not. It's the this is more of the like I think I'm John Wayne versus I think I'm a country singer kind of version of cowboy hats, etc. So it's not that. But fixed blade knives are very good for outdoor use.
Certainly.
What I throw into a pack, etc. I mean, I'll carry my folding knife just because that's just what I do.
And I'm the same way. I've got a couple of fixed blade knives that I have in kind of in packs, but I don't. I've never carried something like that on a regular basis.
Yeah.
So, what are some pros cons about your knife that you like to carry?
Yeah, pros are definitely the. It seems overbuilt. To the point where I'm comfortable using it for whatever.
Yeah.
It's the, you know, a lot of knives are, especially like the everyday carry, smaller knives, people are a little more afraid to use it than if you had some big beat around fixed blade knife, like a K-bar or something like that. I feel this is built the same level of where I can just throw it around, make work happen, and I have no fear of using the tool.
Yeah, and just getting my hands on it for the few minutes before the show, I was impressed with both kind of the construction materials. Everything was really tight together. Everything was held together really well. The actions, you call it the actions still. You know, the way the parts moved, everything was nice and smooth. The blade was definitely thick, kind of like the K-bar that I have at home. Same way, yeah.
And it's that's just kind of the way Benchmade does stuff, is they build stuff to high tolerances. It's all made in the U.S. of A., done properly out of a plant that they got up in Oregon. And one of the cool things with Benchmade is for the life of the knife, you buy a knife through them, they will sharpen the blade for free forever.
Now, don't most companies do that?
Most reputable knife companies will. It's like if you're buying a knife that's actually worth anything, that's worth the $200 you're going to spend on it, they better be able to sharpen it for you for free.
Yeah.
Benchmade will
do. You know, Spyderco will do that. You could just nod or shake your head.
Nope. You're nodding? Yes. Shaking your head. Not helpful. Okay.
Well, Spyderco may or may not actually do this too.
I think they do. Like, if you just go to their. This is the advantage of Golden, is that you can just drive over to their factory outlet in their factory. Mm-hmm. One of the guys I talked to today is like, yeah, I just went over, got it sharpened, because we're looking at getting a knife for one of the guys in my office who's retiring.
Oh, okay.
And it's like, here, try this. It's like, oh, here, try the Benchmade, try the Spyderco, et cetera. Mm-hmm. I mean, I got nothing against Spyderco. I just don't like their style as much as I like Benchmade's style. I never really liked the thumb in the hole
in the
to try and get friction to make it
like
work.
That.
I really like the thumb stud a lot more. Because I feel like I can use the thumb stud a little more easily. Mm-hmm. And it's a better setup. At least as far as I'm concerned. You know, if you're better with the hole in the blade, cool. Good for you, man. Make it work.
Now, on somewhat the other side of the spectrum, I've carried a lot of different knives, and usually they're kind of pieces of crap. But I like to talk
brand.
To El Cheapo, you know, whatever I can kind of get my hands on, I'll carry. A couple of features that I always look for. I really should invest in a good knife, but what I look for in a knife right now is just kind of a couple of features. I like a knife that its folding has some sort of a little bit of assist so that it can open easily. I like a knife that has... what some people call the rescue hook or the seatbelt cutter, the what do you call this? A
shrouded cutter.
Shrouded cutter, yeah.
Or shroud cutter. Either way, I've heard it all four ways, and no one has seemed it.
Everyone knows what a seatbelt cutter looks like, though. Yeah. And so I like a seatbelt cutter on mine, and I also like the kind of window punch on the end. And we talked about the hook and the punch when we did our shears. Raptors, yeah. But I like having those. I've had to use both of them, and I've found them to be useful, so I like having a hook. So the one I carry was kind of issued to the department, has a department logo on it. It's kind of a piece of crap.
Yeah, it looks like about a $20 knife.
Here's the advantage of this, is that maybe this one, because it's got department logo, I probably shouldn't carry this as much, because I would be afraid of losing or breaking this. But the knives that I carry, I'm really not afraid to use, because if I break / lose... it's like meh, whatever.
You break the knife in half,
or you know, when it's
simple,
when it's finally done. Well, I've never broken one. trying to do something that a knife was meant to do, you know. I've only broken them by, like, you know, you drop it on the tip, tip breaks, it's like, yeah, this thing's toast now.
Yeah.
But, you know, when it gets dull, it's like, it's not the end of the world if it just becomes some knife in a drawer somewhere. That's the nice thing about carrying a cheap knife. So, you know, carry what you're comfortable with. If you don't feel like, same thing with the Raptors, what we said. If you don't feel like you're not maybe responsible is not the right word, but if you don't feel ready, if you don't feel ready to carry an $80 knife, then don't carry an $80 knife.
Yeah, this isn't an $80 knife. This is a $250.
Are you serious? I'm not buying
it. I think it was more like $220 or something like that.
That's
retail.
Too expensive.
There's some nice kind of discount sites you can get on, and you go with the public safety kind of discounts, you can get it for a much more reasonable price.
There's no way I'm buying it.
Frankly. You know, that's fair. It's the once you get to the point where you're comfortable that you're not going to lose a $200 tool, then you buy the $200
that's like
tool.
That's like a cell phone, dude.
Okay, well, maybe a crappy cell phone.
Yeah.
You need to buy better gear. It's okay to buy good gear. Especially like when you buy, you know, nice bags to fill with good gear.
You know, it's true.
It works. So that is the downside with the Benchmade stuff is it is super well built and you're getting what you pay for, but you pay a fair bit.
Yeah.
That's a $200 knife, and like the 915 triage that I have was not cheap either.
How much did that one get?
That's
kind of their rescue version.
30, yeah, I think 130. God. Like the same as that knife, except well built.
For like $250, I can buy like another cardiology level stethoscope.
Yeah, but your cardiology stethoscope is not going to help do a dozen things. It's going to help do two things.
Well, really, one thing, just listening to stuff.
Well, okay, I was breaking that down
into
listening
lungs
to lungs and listening to heart.
Oh no, you got bowel sounds too.
Oh, okay,
my
great.
Friend.
Yeah, you have three uses for that tool. Versus, I mean, stab, cut, pry, force, punch. Etc. So, anyway, knives are a great tool. I'm a big fan of a knife. I ended up, I was talking to one of my grandparents' neighbors a long, long time ago, and he told a story about how he was talking to a kid who was going to go to med school, and he asked him, "You carry a pocket knife?" He was like, "No, should I?" Like, "Son, if you can't use a jackknife, how can you be a surgeon?"
That's true enough.
I was like, that's fair. I get that. You know, a good knife is a good resource to have, at least available most of the time.
One more knife I actually want to talk about is a knife I have at home. I should have brought it so that you could kind of get your hand on it. But you know what? You know this knife, the Opinel number 8?
Yeah, I'm familiar with it. I never actually have owned one.
Yeah, so I own one of these. I like it a lot, and it's very interesting because it's very, they like have not changed the design of this for 300 years.
Oh yeah, it's a classic.
It's got a really light, almost, I don't know if it's pine, but it's a light wood handle.
Light.
Yeah, and very simple opening mechanism. You know, very simple, like a slight drop point to it.
Yeah.
Single edge, and the whole thing is surprisingly light. You know, you feel knives these days. You know, they're all steel frame. I don't even know what this weighs. You know, this is like a kilo and a half or so.
Like, I know my knife is heavy. I don't even want to know.
This knife's really, really light, and I used it a lot when I was younger. For like, I used to do some light wood carving, like some small wood carving.
It's a good knife for carving,
and it was excellent for that. And I don't necessarily. It's come back in popularity, kind of actually with the hipster crowd. Unfortunately,
it's the same people who are buying Carhartts again and buying Filson gear again.
Yeah,
and going back and all the stuff that people have known about for hundreds of years.
So of course it's nice that these are regaining popularity. The things I don't like that are regaining popularity is that you've got several imitation brands that are not as well made.
Yeah.
Now this thing's not rock solid. This isn't your Benchmade that you can run over with a car and it'll survive. But you know, you should buy the proper like name brand Opinel number 8 knife. And the numbers, all their knives look exactly the same. The numbers are just the size. So you've got like a Actually, I don't even remember. I think the smaller numbers are like really, they get down to being like inch, less than an inch knife. Tiny little knives. But they still look exactly like this.
Yeah,
they still
mean,
have
once,
the same
once
handle
you have
style.
A design, you have a design.
The number 8 is a kind of good size. It's like a solid 3-4 inch.
Good pocket knife.
Yeah, it's a good pocket knife. I don't necessarily recommend carrying it all the time. If you're into hobby carving, I would definitely recommend it as a good starter for you. And that's, I have much more experience with this kind of style of knife rather than the tactical folding Benchmade.
Well, there's also, you know, in that kind of same range, there's also Mora. Mora, I don't think they make any folding knives. Mm-hmm. They may, I just don't even know. It's the Mora's fixed blade knives are, for what you're paying for, they're actually incredibly decent and incredibly durable. For what, basically paying about $20 or less than $20 for a fixed blade knife that is sharp from the factory,
mm-hmm.
like actually sharp, high quality steel, comes with a sort of holster, mm-hmm. and is a pretty bomber, well built knife. And then you get two or three of them, toss them into packs that you just don't think about, and you've at least got an option squared away, and they're a good option.
Yeah,
they're actually also very well used for carving now.
Okay.
Now that they've come out, they're kind of finer, thin. You can get thinner, finer ones, kind of more like a filleting kind of knife, and they're perfect for it. And they actually have a little carving line that's perfect for that purpose. I don't know. I don't carve stuff. I don't have that kind of time. So knives, good stuff.
Yeah.
If you can afford and you trust yourself not to lose the expensive knife, buy the expensive knife. Mm-hmm. If you can't, whatever, man. Go to Walmart, get on Amazon, get a cheap knife, and use it.
You want to talk multi-tools as well, or do you want to save that
for
another
day? We'll save multi-tools for later, because it's again, an entirely different class of product. And some people think of them the same way as knives, but they're really not. I mean, a knife is one tool. It's a blade. Potentially, you've got a couple other kind of backup ancillary tools on it, like the carbide point or a shroud cutter or whatever.
Yeah.
But it's not the same as, I have pliers and a blade and a screwdriver and a this and a that. So it's, you know, you think of them as different kinds of tools.
And I'll have more to contribute on that because I've owned a lot more multi-tools.
Yeah.
Okay. So let's talk about our kind of one of our two training topics this week is going to be hike and rescues. So this is something we do a fair bit of up here at Highland Rescue is we do these hike and rescues. We've got trails. I think the total distance of all our trails put together is somewhere in the realm of 30 to 40 miles.
It seems about right.
A quarter of that is all on one trail.
Yeah.
We've got a single trail that's between 8 and 10 miles. I've heard different things from different surveyors.
It depends how it's named this year.
Yeah, the naming conventions have been changing. But we have a very long trail. It's the Beaverbrook Trail. And actually, recently, we had a very, very good call that got syndicated national coverage on. We had a lady who was 8 months pregnant become lost at 5 o'clock. So October, November?
It was...
late fall.
It was late fall. I think it was October.
Yeah.
And
so at about 5 o'clock, they get a call for an 8-month pregnant lady lost off of the trail.
Yeah,
who had gone off the trail.
It was a good day.
Oh, so you were on that day.
Yeah. I made it onto that call.
I was at the airport, and man, I was kicking myself because I wanted to come back.
You didn't want to be on that call.
I missed
it. We didn't end up doing anything. That was the biggest thing.
Unfortunately. I would love to have delivered a baby.
Well,
in the
and that didn't happen. the big thing is these are calls where they're too close to civilization to warrant full search and rescue. But they're too far where I can't just drive up next to the patient and go, oh, you must be our patient. Hello, how are you? Let's go.
Mm-hmm.
We still have to do some of the search and rescue work, and that gets a little bit interesting.
And the toughest thing that we've had to deal with lately, and we actually just recently made a proper written standard operating procedure for our hike-ins, was that we had our sole ALS resource. When we're up here, we've mentioned before, we've got one paramedic on the mountain. Most of the time, there's one. In a fairly decent radius, there is one paramedic. And being a paramedic, being an EMS professional at all, very action-oriented people, and so you see kind of a problem in front of you, which is like this person is down on this trail somewhere, all right? What do you want to do? You want to grab a pack and go.
Go get him, boy!
Yeah. Unfortunately, what you have to do as the medic is kind of sit on your hands and wait until we have a proper location. Because if you get 2 miles in on a trail and they find out, and this happens all the time, it's like, oh, it's 2 miles in on the other end of the Beaver Brook. Now you're 2 miles out from your vehicle before you can't even start to get close to that patient for another half hour. And that's a serious problem. So what you have to, what we have to do up here, and we've finally defined it, that the medical resource really has to wait until we have confirmed patient location. So sometimes we get that from Jeffco Open Space Rangers.
Yeah.
Which is great. So we have one ranger with the person.
Yeah,
they get one person, one ranger with the patient, and then one ranger at the trailhead. And there you go. That's my ideal situation, because he'll lead me in like a bloodhound. But other than that, when you have to start like sending teams in to start looking, you really have to sit back, and it's very difficult. This is, I think, the greatest difficulty, at least psychologically, for the rescuers, is that to be able to sit back and go, "No, we're sitting here, and that's what my job is to sit here."
And that is, even if you find out later that this is the closest access point, we've been sitting on it for an hour now, and they find him, that's the closest way to get in, etc. And that can be a real pain. But the big thing is, this is a planning question more than anything. And knowing that it can be difficult to locate the patient and planning on it being difficult to locate the patient is really the way to make this work. Kind of another complicating and mitigating factor is the elements themselves. So, you know, if it's the middle of the day on a summer day and it's 70 degrees out and it's beautiful and we've got not a cloud in the sky, no fronts expected to move through today, that's fantastic. That happens maybe 3 days a year.
Yeah, not exactly a typical scenario on this. Usually there's something.
Yeah, it's either getting cloudy and there's a storm an hour out.
Or there's a wildfire on the other side of the road.
Or it's dark.
The last one we saw, yeah.
It's getting dark and it's getting colder and it's getting windier.
Yeah.
Or whatever. And that's another important planning challenge that you need to think of, is making sure that your personnel that are normally used to doing urban front country work of, you have some jacket on because you're walking between your truck and the residence of the patient, but you need to be thinking more in, I need to have stuff to be out for a little while.
Yeah.
You can do well with a crappy jacket for the 10 seconds it takes you to get your stuff from the truck and the minute it takes to walk to the house. You can kind of nut up and deal with it.
Yeah.
But if you're hiking in 2 miles, your awful jacket is either going to kill you with being too warm or it's going to kill you from being too cold.
Yeah.
So you need to actually plan your gear effectively.
So management of this patient and treatment of this patient. when you finally do like have a set location, make sure you bring enough of what you think you'll need. We have a backcountry kit, which is kind of nice. It's a full kit that you bring in. And there's mixed opinions about this backcountry kit, but I like it. But sometimes you need something more than that. The two or three main things that I like to bring that aren't really set are A, warm saline.
Yep.
So we have a saline warmer, and you need to bring the warm saline.
That goes into somebody's coat?
Yeah,
inside
pocket of the coat.
Yep.
And I grab all the warm saline that we have. I stuff it all together because it all keeps each other warm.
Yep.
And
amazing how heat transfer works.
Exactly. So the warm saline, because I've found that more often we have someone who's at risk of a cold problem than of a heat problem. Even though it gets hot out there and we have more of these in the hot times, we're more at risk for somebody having a cold problem than a hot problem.
The rain's showing up, the sun is going down,
exactly.
The wind is picking up. Yeah. It's always going to be hypothermia. Cody Lundin of Dual Survival, the kind of weird one that didn't wear shoes.
No, I read his book.
Yeah, his book, 98.6 degrees.
I have that book at home.
Fantastic book. It's all about core temperature management, because that is, there's the classical, the rule of threes for survival of like 3 minutes without this.
Well, it's 3 minutes without
air. 3 hours without this. Yeah, it's 3 hours without protection from the elements.
Yeah.
It's like 3 seconds without blood flow to the heart or something like that.
Well, I've always heard it starts with 3 minutes without air. And it's 3 hours without environmental protection.
Yep.
And it's 3 days without water and 3 weeks without food.
Yep. And that's kind of the classic way to do that. But it's hypothermia is going to be the first thing that'll kill someone outside. I mean, unless they're like obviously being mauled by a bear or getting crushed by a boulder or burned or something like that.
Something more violent, yeah.
But generally it's going to be hypothermia is going to be the major killer or the major thing that you're going to have to worry about treating. So always plan for hypothermia treatment.
On the side of kind of goofy survivalist things, during one of the hunting safety courses I took once, the man recommended that you bring that you carry a suture kit with you so that you could suture a wound in the field. I was kind of like, excuse me, can you not encourage people to try and suture themselves in the field?
Yeah, that moves a little bit.
Just
onto the,
bind it and go, guys. Yeah. So don't do that. The last thing that I like to carry is bring your narcs. Half the time, what we've got, you know, actually I say way more than half the time. Sometimes we've got this kind of pregnant female wandered off into the woods. Now we don't know what's going on. She ended up actually being a decent trauma. But initially that kind of wasn't the call out, you know. More than half the time, though, it's a trauma. Somebody fell down, or somebody fell off their bike, or somebody did something.
Dislocated shoulder, or fractured clavicle, two broken ribs, kind of the classic head over. Bike accident.
Now, let me tell you, you got a 2-mile hike out. You brought the Stokes basket with your big wheel because your fire department's nice enough to bring that, or you've got your own. But even with a method to carry them out, they're going to want some morphine, people. Mm-hmm. So bring your morphine. Bring your fentanyl. Snow them down. Now, our current Denver Metro protocols say that they need to be on SpO2 monitoring when you give a opiate, but I've had a personal conversation with our medical director about how some of these rules are acceptable to be bent whilst in the backcountry scenario. So the $50,000 50-pound life pack is not worth the weight. It's not worth the bringing it in.
If I can carry 3 more bags of saline instead of the life pack 15, you're probably better off with the saline.
Yeah.
Or another blanket. Another blanket, or the another saline.
Well, that was my last thing. Sometimes you want to bring some more blankets just in case. We have blankets. We have space blankets in the backcountry kit. But bringing just some extra cloth blankets, never a bad idea.
But make sure you've got something weatherproof for the exterior.
That's what the space blanket's for. Yeah. You know, that's that kind of waterproof, reflective material.
I mean, there's the classic Knowles hypothermia wrap of you do this, and then, like, sleeping bag, and then blanket, and then plastic tarp or plastic sheet over that. It's like, that's all fine and good. If you have the time, you remember to grab the materials, and you kind of have this kit prepared to go. Realistically, 2 space blankets. One for the inside to contact with the patient, do a good job reflecting the heat, and one to be on the outside to be something waterproof. Because if it starts raining and you've got cotton blankets on the patient, they're just going to sit and soak and soak and soak and get colder and colder and colder
heavier.
And colder. And we've just wasted all of the work that we've done. Even if the patient wasn't hypothermic to begin with, it's raining and they're completely covered in cotton blankets that are now soaked through, they're going to be hypothermic.
Another thing, I usually give my jacket to the patient, and I'll tell you why. And obviously, you don't want to do this if it's going to compromise your
own
provider.
Safety.
But what I've found is that in the coldest weather, after I hike in with a pack on, I'm kind of looking to ditch my parka. And the hike out, maybe at the very end, I start to feel a little chilly, but I keep myself sort of warm with the hiking. So I'm a big fan of
metabolic heat versus insulation.
So I'm looking to ditch my parka already because I'm sitting there kind of sweaty, and I've warmed it up for him, and it's got 3 liters of warm saline in it. So even if that doesn't go into somebody's veins, now it's used to warm them. If you're not worried about like doing that kind of active warming with the IV fluids. Those are the main things. Bring some blankets. Bring your warm saline. Bring your fentanyl.
Glucometer. Glucometer.
Glucometer is in the bag.
If it's not in the bag, you know, make sure it is. Subtle things like that.
Yeah, because if you've got an AMS, you need to... What?
We pulled the glucometers out of the backcountry bags.
That's
one's now the one that's sitting in the...
in the rig?
Yeah, that sits in the rig.
Yeah.
And we put a little reminder card that says, remember to grab the glucometer.
It's probably because we're low on glucometers.
Yeah, glucometers aren't free, or the strips aren't free. The glucometers are. So let's go into planning a little bit more. The first step in doing proper planning always is to kind of assess the risk and assess the needs that you have. You know, if you've got one trail that is kind of an urban green belt right on the front country trail, you probably don't need to throw days and days of effort at
like your Lookout Mountain Nature Center.
Yeah, if or you want to look up what we're talking something about. Something real here. Close, or something that's like the side of the highway. So we've got the new trail that they just put in between two exits that kind of parallels the interstate.
Yeah, up at the Genesee.
Yeah, Exit. Yeah. Whatever it's called, Peak to Plains or something like that.
The Buffalo Overlook.
Yeah. But there's some new trails that are kind of going in that way. Those don't require as much planning and as much preparation as something that is a proper single track trail. Something where you're going over rough terrain, you've got to be prepared to carry the load as opposed to just move the load. And you can't just take the pram out, rely on those wheels, and just roll it
on roll it onto the concrete.
So take a few minutes up and assess your district and see what you've got. Either if you're on the fire side or the EMS side or whatever side you're on, even the law enforcement side, assess your district and figure out what you got going on. You got big, long trails. You got a lot of district to cover. Maybe this is something you need to spend a lot of time planning for. And the other thing there is understand your call history and where incidents are happening. There are some very common spots where people rack their bikes.
Mm-hmm.
It's right as the trail changes, or there's some roots, or there's a water bar. There's like five or six spots that are the classic. About a quarter mile from the intersection of these trails, it's always where that wreck's going to be. Which is super helpful, because we can plan, we know how to get there, we know what it is. And it's a very, very helpful consideration. You know, and then there are trails where there just aren't a lot of incidents, and that's good. They're either not very popular, or they're pretty safe. Either way, it's something to know about, and you spend your planning time and effort more on where the incidents are likely, and that's just, you know, good use of judicious time. Plan for your personnel and your equipment. Kind of this is where fire and EMS need to cooperate to make sure that the plans happen effectively. The good way to run these, especially if it's not the, you know, it's pre-identified rec point one, or whatever you're going to call them. If it's not there, you need to be thinking more like a search and rescue team is thinking. Your search and rescue teams are thinking in the, we're going to locate quickly, and then we're going to focus on extraction. And that's how we need to do this. So you send out teams of two, minimum of two. Do not send anyone out solo. We're being, send out anyone solo. Had someone whining that, you never go in solo on, like, an IDLH environment. It's like, hey, how about, like, February in the Colorado Rockies with the sun going down?
That's IDLH.
I'd argue that that's immediately dangerous to your life and health. If you're inadequately equipped, don't have good communications, etc., that's an immediate danger to your life and health. So go with someone and carry the correct gear. And we'll talk to you in a second. So minimum two on your search teams. Go out, go fast. Find the guy.
And it doesn't have to be that many more than two. It doesn't have to be really three. Two is a good number for
two guys who can move quickly, split some gear between them. You don't need much. You don't need the huge heavy kit. You need two guys with enough BLS gear that they can get things started.
That's all you need.
Good navigation and good communications. And they're going to be out there for a while, so proper gear for that. And then hold a team of 6 to 10 back at your staging area to be the extraction team. All right, or extrication team, or whatever you want to call them.
I think extraction is really the right...
People like to call it extrication because it sounds all cool.
Sounds like fire.
Tools. It is fire. This is firework. It's fire and medical.
It's ranger work. It's ranger work.
It is, but...
It's good.
It's all still the same. Minimum 6 to 10, because kind of your standard litter team is going to be a minimum of 4. And you're going to want to... Bare minimum of 4.
Yeah.
You're going to want to have more than that, so 6 is good, plus a couple medical guys, and then you want to be able to rotate people out or carry the extra gear, because packs are going to get shed, the guy who wrecked, he's going to have a bike that's going to have to come back, he's going to have a pack or something like that, you're not going to carry the pack.
I mean, I've seen a guy who had a bike that cost more than my car. He was very concerned about
it. We're taking the bike. It's just good patient care at that point. It's good patient advocacy. So think about that, plan for that. 6 to 10 is kind of what you're thinking. Remember your search team, you can put to work on this, but those guys are going to be a little bit gassed because they probably like jogged some of the trail. Be nice to them, cut them a little break, have them carry the bike.
Yeah.
Don't have them carry the stretcher. Be nice. and have them continue the patient care. That's an easy way to kind of maintain some continuity of care. You know, you've been talking to Joe. Joe knows who you are, and life is a little easier that way. So plan for, I mean, these responses are going to be big. Get a lot of people. You're going to want basically 15 to 20 people on this call.
Yeah.
Three search teams, give or take. So that's six people plus another 10 people plus a handful of people to be at command and to do mapping and things like that.
Yeah.
You're 20 people. And that's not quite enough people if you've got a lot of trail miles to cover. Let's talk equipment. 10 essentials. It's kind of the classic Boy Scout solution. It works. You want all of those elements to be on every person that goes out. Really no good exceptions to that. Unless, like, you're going less than a quarter of a mile from the truck.
You could see the patient.
Like, you can see the patient.
And it's not a hike.
You can see your truck. It's not a hike-in. You don't need your full gear. But really, if you're going further than that, and you have a potential of not being able to find your truck immediately or find civilization immediately, you need to be packing the 10 essentials.
And we've got 10 essentials just in our backcountry medical kit.
We've got the start of the 10 essentials in our kit. Carry your own kit. You can trust your own work a little bit better than a kit that's been hanging around for a while. So it's something to consider, something to think about. Look it up. All the good lists are out there. Wikipedia's got a good listing that's pretty helpful. Something to think about. Carry good communications. My God.
Now this is tough.
You need good comms.
Because on our longest trail, we also have the biggest comm problems. It's in these twists and turns of a valley that the VHF won't, the direct line of sight doesn't work very well, and it's buried in all these pine trees. The 800 doesn't like to penetrate through any of that. It's really rough. So this can be difficult. Depends on your district. This comes back to knowing your district. But the comms problem, it needs to be addressed. Everybody, before you send a team out, we need to know that they've got a radio.
They need,
you know, we've got
at
to know
least one
like
radio.
Yeah.
They need to be on a channel that everyone can use. Find one of the mutual aid channels if you have to, because fire needs to be able to talk to medical, who needs to be able to talk to the rangers, who needs to be able to talk to the cops.
Yeah.
It's that simple. And if they don't want to play well, you need to play well. This is the incident where we do need good, unified comms. Because if someone finds the patient, that initial update, location, and the situation of the patient needs to be relayed to everyone quickly so resources can start moving there. It's a waste of time to not do that.
So last thing, that every team should have a medical kit of some sort. And I'm going to go through what I want to see on a medical kit for just, like, say, a scouting team, you know, a search team.
Yeah.
I want basic bandaging.
Yep.
So that's some gauze, some Curlex, some triangle bandages.
Something to stop
that's easy.
Bleed.
Yeah, exactly. I'm a huge fan of QuikClot.
It's a good option.
We'll probably talk about it at some point.
Yeah.
I'm a huge fan of QuikClot. I carry that. That's one of the few things I carry in my little everyday green bag that I have with me on every call. Quit some QuikClot. Some splinting gear. So all that is, that's a SAM splint.
Bring
a SAM splint, okay?
That'll do ya.
Nice and easy. And then the last thing that I want to see is actually a blood pressure cuff and a stethoscope. Because one of the things that me as a medic is the difference between me hiking out, hustling out, or running is I want to see some vitals. So if the scout team can say, okay, we got a patient location, and, you know, he's 110 over 76. And I don't like hearing, like, ah, he's fine. I don't like hearing that. Nobody wants to hear that. You know, if I gave a handoff report and went, ah, this guy's fine, they'd be like, okay, well, give me the numbers now. Yeah. So if you could give your paramedic some numbers, it'll either increase his response because this guy is 80 over 40 and fading fast, or, you know, maybe it's like, okay, we can take a little bit more time to get to this guy because he's all stable. You know, we got no active bleeds, anything like that. And that's really the main things. And that doesn't take up much space at all.
No.
That doesn't take up much more space than a woman's clutch. You know, we're talking about, like, what I mean, they can't see our hands. So,
yeah.
Like a loaf of bread.
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean,
like a sourdough loaf of bread. That's
your entire
it.
Scout's med kit can be the size of a loaf
yeah.
of bread, not the blood pressure cuff, et cetera. That's too much for a blood pressure cuff. but your entire med kit should be that size.
Yeah.
You can easily fit into cheap Walmart backpacks, mm-hmm. get a little dry bag to toss it into, or some sort of way to carry this with kind of your personal essentials so you don't end up becoming a patient too.
Yep.
The big thing is you plan on searching, then extracting. Don't do this just, we're going to send all the resources in one specific path, and it's going to be a long little line, and you hope you find the patient eventually. Send in your search teams, locate the patient, have the search team initiate care, so they need some sort of kit for that. Send the extrication team or extraction team or the pick them up and go team to that location, because you found them, and there's probably an easier way to get there than the way you went in the first time, mm-hmm. and then get them out.
Now, that those three things that we talked about, if you guys run with mainly EMRs, that's EMR-level stuff.
Yeah.
Okay? Bandaging, splinting, and taking up blood pressure, EMR-level stuff. Don't worry too much about the high-level stuff. Don't worry too much about moving him, unless there's something causing a direct threat to his life based on his position.
Air.
Like a fire, yeah. Last hiking I went on, we went to the hiking and then discover a wildfire. Luckily, it was on the other side of the road. Now, I had no wildland training at this point. I was a little terrified because I'm sitting there downwind of a fire. There's like smoke coming in. And I didn't realize how beneficial a road is to that situation. It's helpful to have a road in between you and the fire. I was still like, okay, I'm gonna go about a mile in, and then I'm gonna hear that the wildfire came in. It's like, oh boy, here we go.
Hope you brought your easy makeup.
Thankfully, this guy was he ended up being 100 yards up the trail, because this old salty bastard had hiked his own ass 2 miles out after completely reconfiguring his face like Mr. Potato Head.
That's the spirit.
Yeah, nice guy. So we got lucky on that, but you know, there was concern there, and I forget where I was trying to go with this, but if we hadn't had a good location on him, we could have gotten really lost, and we could have ended up in a very dangerous situation. There was potential for hazards there.
So that's hike and rescues in a nutshell. It's not too hard. It just takes a little bit of thought in advance. Don't just rush into it. This is not the scene where you just charge straight to the patient. Plan ahead, think, and it'll actually work a lot better, and you'll waste a lot less time.
Yeah.
All right.
So, kind of our medical topic of the week is panic attacks. Now, I've got a lot of personal experience with this, not myself. I've never myself experienced a panic attack.
I mean, I think I've OD'd on caffeine before. And
no, pre-workout
like it was
doesn't
like
count.
That. Okay. Like, 3 scoops of pre-workout, my heart won't stop, it's not good. I'm just going to sit here and hold on to this chair and focus on not dying.
That's not exactly what we're talking about here, okay? It's definitely been rising in recent years and in the trends of sociology and there's been a lot of research on as to why. I'm not a big why guy, I'm more of a big what and how kind of guy. It's not that much of a concern for me as to why this is happening. However, the reality is that there's a huge spike in panic attacks in the last 20 years. Panic and anxiety-based disorders has gone up insanely. Now, some people just say...
I mean, I would just quickly speculate that that's just an increase in our knowledge and our ability to diagnose.
Now, that is one of the... they do account for that. And they say that a lot of it certainly is that people who are just getting treated more.
Yeah. Like hysteria used to be just a random diagnosis that encompassed all of these things.
It's true, and we used to have shell shock, and then we had battle fatigue, and now we have PTSD. These things evolve. But that, even accounting for that, there's data showing that there's an increase in this. Like I said, I'm not a big why guy. It doesn't matter to me why this is happening. The main thing is that it is happening. You need to recognize that it's happening. Panic attacks get a really bad rap because all it takes is 1 or 2, 3 a.m. panic attack calls, and you start getting real pissed off at panic attacks. And I get it. It's understandable when these guys, especially who work a high volume, when I was working my high volume stuff, I got woken up for panic attacks many times. Because I had more history in dealing with psychiatric hospitals and psychiatric conditions, I was a little more resistant to getting salty about the 3 a.m. What I got salty about was the 3 a.m. hobo in a dumpster who's just too drunk to be A&O and is like, ah, God.
He's actually a patient, yeah.
Gotta take him to the hospital. He doesn't want to go. I don't want to take him. There's no real reason for him to be there. The hospital didn't want him. Societal problem. That's the topic for another day. But I didn't get upset about the panic attacks. One thing that I talk about whenever I talk about psychiatric conditions is that a hard thing to keep in mind and something that will help you both is that whatever it is, it's real to this person.
Mm.
And there's a very small number of people who truly are kind of your Munchausen. And if you're not familiar with that term, it's a psychological condition where one fakes or in some way makes synthetic symptoms for attention. It's actually a fairly low volume of these people are doing it for the attention. Now, you say that this maybe a suicidal attempt in a young, in a teenager, or a panic, a quotes panic attack in a young teenager, is like they want attention in a sense, but it's not a conscious decision that they say, I just want attention, so I'm going to create this scenario. That's what we call Munchausen. And that's a very low population. So if you keep in mind that whatever this is, even if it's complete and total bullshit, it's real to them. And I have
bullshit.
Medically, medically. So you really do have to treat this with a lot of compassion, like you do other psychiatric conditions and psychiatric problems. I know someone who I went to high school with, and she suffers from panic attacks regularly. I only really found out about it after I became a medical professional, because you know how it is. Someone finds out you're an EMT, and all of a sudden it's, can you look at my rash?
You're the doctor.
So that I didn't find this out until later, but she described it the best way, actually, when I talked to her about it once. She said, I have had more panic attacks than I can think of, and yet every single time, I am absolutely convinced that this one's the heart attack that's killing me. And he says, it doesn't matter that I know that I've had 36 in the, year to date. It doesn't matter. In the moment, I'm convinced, yeah, I know, but this is the one. This is the one that's actually killing me. So the main thing that I have to deal with panic attacks, obviously, rule out your bloody STEMI. And I've got a second story afterwards about rule out your STEMI. Rule out your actual medical problems. Do your medicine first, okay? After you're fairly certain it's a panic attack, it's not a bad idea to still take these people to the hospital, because we can't really rule out anything. What our medical director likes to say all the time is, we don't medically clear people in the field. Okay, no, only a doctor medically clears somebody. Okay, so we can sort of rule out stuff. Like, I can sort of rule out a STEMI, but I can't rule out a heart attack, because there are heart attacks without STEMIs. Yep. It happens all the time. So it's a good idea for these people to go to the hospital. B, when you're kind of going down that panic attack road, let's say history of panic attacks, person's going like, look, this is a panic attack.
16-year-old female going down that track.
You know,
versus the 45-year-old male who's overweight, pale, cool, diaphoretic, and is clutching his chest in pain.
Well, you'll see pale, cool, diaphoretic out of panic attacks.
That's true.
You'll see they look very much like heart attacks. That's the scary thing about them. That's the scary thing medically about them, is that they look and the person presents symptoms very similar to a heart attack. So you can't always go, oh, 16-year-old female, probably not a heart attack, 45-year-old male, overweight, just ate a steak.
All of the risk criteria.
Or, fat female, 40, farty, your risk factors for cardiac problems.
Yep.
That's not always going to be you're not always going to be able to determine that way. But if you're going sort of down the differential diagnosis of a panic attack, it doesn't stop really being a medical emergency, okay? It's just a different kind of medical emergency. Compassion is key here, okay? Talk to the person, kind of talk them down is not exactly the right word, but just talk calmly and go, look, everything looks good on the monitor right now. I've got my monitor here. Everything looks good. We're going to take you to the hospital. You're going to take some deep breaths. Here's some oxygen, and everything's going to be just fine. If your protocols allow it and the person's starting to get really messed up, and now it's nighttime, it's time for a Versed nap, okay? If your protocols allow it, obviously. One thing I want to say about the Versed nap is that we don't practice punitive medicine, period.
No.
All right? You don't get to give someone a ride in the Ativan because they're an asshole. You don't, okay?
And they're not getting a 16 in the hand.
No.
Because they're being a pain. Exactly. And you don't think it's an actual emergency.
Second, story I want to end with regarding a panic attack. I had, we got called for, it wasn't middle of the night, but we're talking like 10, 11, you know.
Yeah,
this is
there.
This is in Los Angeles. You know, we roll in. It was actually pretty early on in my internship as a paramedic. And so we roll in. Very low-income neighborhood, small apartment, probably about 16 people living in this. Like, maybe two-bedroom, you know, Hispanic family.
That's
right?
Not a good day.
Everybody's yelling and screaming in Spanish. I don't speak a word of Spanish. And so my firefighters kind of clear the room. Which was helpful to me. You know, everybody basically gets kicked out to the front lawn.
Yep, that's
except for my patient who was
a fire.
Exactly. And the my patient was the matron, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
Sitting kind of, you know, upset, but sitting on the couch, semi-quiet, not feeling good. I don't, you know, she's kind of breathing heavy, but it doesn't look like much to me. Doesn't look like much to anybody. I run a 12 on her, and when I pull out my 12, it was an interesting dichotomy because they really went with the throw him into the deep end and let him drown method, which is good.
If you learn that way.
When I started doing something that they didn't like, that wasn't necessarily bad medicine, but they just didn't want to do, like me doing a 12 lead on this patient, they would get very irritated with me. And one of the professionals on scene came up and told me that this was nothing but Hispanic panic. And I got a big problem with saying something like that on a scene.
Yeah, that's over the line.
That's unprofessional.
Mark
at zero. It's over the line. 12 lead comes back. The machine says it's clean.
It's because I trust the machine on everything.
The biggest tombstone MI I have seen in my life in three contiguous leads. And the machine marked it clean. A normal ECG. And they're like trying to pack up and leave. And I'm like, look at this. And they got mad at me and they asked me if I was a cardiologist, which they love to do. I've got a different soapbox about that. But if you're trained to read a 12 lead, actually read your 12 lead. Don't let the machine do it for you. This is my John Henry story. I beat the machine. I ran the 12 lead a second time and it came back star STEMI criteria. They, of course, wanted to run it a third time because they thought, oh, it felt positive this time.
What's going to happen on the third run? It's not going to say that?
Well, you know, if it's 2 out of 3 not STEMI, then they can leave. Then it's sign here and we go home and sleep. third time comes back, star STEMI. I was really happy that it did because I was upset because you could see it. I mean, really, you could train a chimp to find this MI. It was obvious. It wasn't your 1 millimeter elevation. It was a tombstone. The next call would have been in the morning to pronounce this lady. And she had nothing but a somewhat elevated respiration rate.
Impressive.
And that was it. No real chest pain. No nothing like this. This is, and they, you know, it was your textbook kind of panic attack. Very stressful scenario. Everybody's yelling at each other in the family. I get it. And to be fair, it looked like not a heart attack. But do your medicine. This is a little bit of a tangent off of panic attacks because this was the panic attack that was a heart attack.
Yeah.
What's much more common is the panic attack that is a panic attack that the patient says, I feel like I'm dying, I'm having a heart attack, my chest hurts, and it's really a panic attack. But the only way we know that is when they go to the hospital, they get a full cardiac workup, and it's nothing. That's the only way we really know that it's not a cardiac incident, that you've actually got a panic attack to deal with. So, kind of closing thoughts about that. Compassion. Please, just compassion. Treat it like a psychiatric call, even though it's so common that it's almost thought of as not a psychiatric call. You know, it's not your schizophrenic who's got spiders crawling out of his eyes. That's a different kind of psychiatric.
The purple mushrooms are talking to me kind of guy.
Exactly. This is a different kind. It's much more common, much more subtle, and often gets overlooked. Please just use some compassion. I know it's 3 a.m., but realize that this emergency is an emergency to them. That's all I got on that subject.
If you were solidly convinced that you were dying, treat it the same as if you had the same level of conviction as the patient.
Precisely.
I guess it can be that simple.
So, on our notes, though, I do have how to treat. I brushed on it, but let me just go over that.
Yeah.
So, treatment. It's like a comfort thing, you know. Do your good medicine. Oxygen's decent. It helps them out. Position of comfort and that nice, calm voice. Talk to them. We flipped back and forth in the psychiatric health world of whether it's good to say, yes, I see the spiders too, or whether it's good to say, no, I don't see the spiders. Our current kind of understanding is actually a little bit in between those two. If you have someone who has hallucinations, you tell them, that seems like it's really scary.
That's easy.
You don't affirm that what they say is real, and you don't deny what they say is not real.
Because you're not lying.
Exactly. All you're saying is that sounds really tough to you.
Yeah.
When someone opens up to you and tells you about a problem, what we've found is that what they're much more looking for is not necessarily an answer to the problem, not whether their problem is real or not. All they want is they want to know that you heard them.
Yep.
And that'll help. So you deal with someone who's got the anxiety. What that looks like with an anxiety attack is, I know that seems really scary. I know that you've got a lot of pain. Is there anything I could do to make you feel a little better right now? You know, we're going to take you to the hospital. They're going to take care of you. What can I do while we're going there? That's the best thing you can do for them. It's real simple.
Yeah.
All right. You have anything to add?
No, I think that's a pretty good breakdown on panic attacks as a concept. I know it's something that isn't well covered in training programs.
Yeah.
And it's just something that's super easy to get salty about and just brush under the rug.
Easy.
Because it's the same as the unknown injury traffic accident that you've been on a dozen times today. And it's there's not going to be anything out there. I'm not even going to bother to put on my snow pants and my warm jacket because I'm just going to stay in the truck. And then you find a 10-car wreck with vehicles flipped over, and you're going to have a fun night out.
Exactly.
It's the same level of don't get complacent. The fire alarm at 3 a.m. that keeps going off, treat it like the structure fire every single time. Because one of these days it will be the structure fire, and you don't want to get caught without your gear. It's the same kind of logic. It's their emergency. Treat it like it's their emergency and that you're choosing to help them.
Okay, that's all we got for you this week.
All right. Thanks for listening. Thanks for training. Hope you got something good out of it. Feel free to visit us on Facebook. Subscribe on iTunes or SoundCloud or whatever other tool you have. If you like what you hear, go ahead and drop a rating on either iTunes or SoundCloud. And let us know what you think. You got ideas, anything, feedback, let us know. Thanks so much. Have a good night.